Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show. I am your host, Lisa Stone, back home in Atlanta after some crazy travels over the last few weeks. I am glad to be home and settle back in, trying to get back into a routine, which is, as y'all know, kind of a challenge during the summer months. Everybody's kind of on a different plane, and trying to get coordinated is always a bit confusing, but we're doing our best around here. And I just want to say that I am really, really excited about today's guest, because not only does she have experience as a junior player coming up through the ranks, but she is also now a tennis mom and has so much information to share with us, so much experience to share, and I know you guys and I are going to learn a ton today. So before I bring on today's guest, and before I even tell you who it is, I want to go to a quick commercial. Our call-in number today, as always, is 714-583-6853. Make a note of it. If you have questions, we'd love to hear from you, and we'll be right back with today's show after this commercial.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Welcome back to Parenting Aces. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and I'm so pleased to introduce today our guest, Carling Bassett-Siguso. Carling, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Lisa, for having me.
I've got this whole long bio on you that your friend Tim emailed to me. But instead of reading about your history and all that, I think it would be much more interesting and much more fun if we just kind of start talking and let it come out in the course of our conversation. As I mentioned in the intro, you were a top junior tennis player. You played on the tour. You dabbled in all sorts of different areas professionally and now have five of your own kids. Are all of them playing tennis? Or
I'm exhausted. I'm exhausted just listening to you saying that. Actually, I have a 17-year spread between my first three and my recent two that are under 3 years old. And, yes, it's still the same husband, because I know that's generally the next question everybody asks. but let's just say I'm completely a different person now than I was when I really raised my first three. And the first three definitely, Holden, he's 20, just turned 25, and Carling is 22, and my youngest son is, he just turned 20. And, yes, they all had scholarships at IMG, the Volatieri, at Nick, excuse me, Nick Volatieri's, and I trained under Nick Volatieri, so it was it was a really great experience for them and for myself, because once we sold our academy on the east coast of Florida, Seduco Bassett, which IMG also bought, we moved over to the west coast of Florida. And it was a lot different than it is with these two, let's just say. I think you can ask me the question that you need to ask, but I'm two totally different people. And there were good parts and there were bad parts. I mean, everybody says, oh, what a great life, and da-da-da. But I wasn't a perfect mother. And, you know, I did the best that I could with what I had. And, you know, I was still playing professionally. I was running a business. Once we built the facility, you know, I was on the court full-time. Tennis was still, it was like a corporation for me. I mean, it was, wow. That's all I had, really, at that point of my life. And I married a professional tennis player. So it was very isolating in a sense. So it was almost as if my children, there was no way that they couldn't have played.
Right, right. Well, so you tapped an area that I do want to talk about, but I'm going to wait to bring it up. I want to just touch on the fact that you trained at Bollettieri when you were coming up, and you were there really in the golden era of Nick Bollettieri and the academy. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what it was like to be in that environment as a young athlete coming up. And I don't know this, were you living there? Was your family there too? Or were you there just, you know, with the other kids and the coaches? Or what was your experience like?
Oh, well, it basically started, my father was looking at some land in Longboat Key, Florida, which he had heard about a tennis coach who was up and coming and was having great success, and his name was Nick Bollettieri. And I, at the time, had just turned 11 years old and was a complete tomboy. I wore boys' speedos. My name was Tommy Terrific. I played every sport, boys' hockey, boys' soccer. I did play tennis, you know, three times a week with my father. And that was the sport, really, that my father wanted all of us to kind of graduate into, because he was a former Davis Cup player himself, and he had a passion and a love for it like no other. So he brought me down with him to Florida to look at the land, and then he called up Nick, and he brought me over to the Colony Beach and Tennis Resort, and I hit with Nick, and he was probably one of the greatest coaches there is. And I mean, it's sad to say that he hasn't been inducted into the Hall of Fame with all the success he's had with his athletes, tennis players. But yes, at the very beginning, I lived with him full time. I was sent to him, I was 11. And from then on until I turned professional, I basically lived with him and my parents. They came down periodically because my father built a townhouses. It was called the Players Club, and it was down the beach. So they would come down as much as they could, because I obviously had a younger sister, an older sister, and an older brother. And so it was difficult for my mom to, she couldn't be at both places, obviously, at the same time. But there was only about 15 of us when I went there, and we all lived in different pros' houses, and I happened to fall into Nick's house. And it was a lot different than living in a normal household, I will tell you that.
I can imagine.
Yeah, well, it was different then than it is now, because all these kids homeschool now. Then
right.
Everybody went to school, still went to school, and then you trained, you know, in the afternoon. And Harry Hopman was the big deal at that time. And so Nick kind of modeled, I feel, his academy after Harry Hopman's. But obviously they're two totally different gentlemen. And from then, we went to school till 12:30. And then from 1:30 until 5:30, we trained. And then from 5:30 until 8:00, we did homework. 8, and it was a very, very strict environment.
And you did all this as a group?
Well,
you did all this with the other players?
Yeah, there were not a lot of us at the very beginning. And in some way, I felt that like Nick got great players at that. He had Jimmy Arias when I was there, and he was 13, and I think he was winning the A-teams at that time. He was the top junior in the country. And then he got Kathleen Horvath, who at 13, if I'm correct, she was the youngest to play the U.S. Open. I came, and I was like this little rich kid who was terrible. So, I was. I lost first round in the Nationals the summer before I went to Knicks, okay? 1-0 and 1-0 in the back round 12s. Within 6 months of being with Nick, I went to the clay courts that next summer, won both the singles and the doubles.
Wow.
So you're looking at a huge, huge transition in my game. I mean, yeah, I was a year older and it was, 12, but still. I mean, going from losing in the first round 0-0 and the first round back draw 1-0, it's a huge achievement to the person who's training you and to yourself, because in a lot of ways I felt that I wasn't getting the attention like Jimmy and Kathleen were at the time. And so I was very, hungry, and I was very competitive, there's no doubt. And so was my dad. Eventually, a couple of years into living with Nick, I mean, he built Nick a tennis court in his backyard. And that's when I really excelled, because we'd come back and then we'd train even more than all the other kids. That's when more and more teenagers came in, and the house would get full at Nick's, and then eventually everybody moved to a motel that was on Manatee Avenue, and it just blossomed. I mean, it flourished within such a short period of time. It was quite incredible to really be part of such a, I mean, it's such success to see somebody achieve and to see what Nick has, really done and how many players he has put on the tour. And really, I don't think he gets the credit for that a lot of the time, just because he wasn't himself a professional player. And he, never really picked up a racket till later in his life. So,
mm-hmm.
It really is quite amazing, the story, if you look at it. And I know he's writing his autobiography now personally, so it's going to be quite fascinating.
Yeah, I'm really anxious to read that. I had the chance to meet him very, very briefly a few years ago, and he's just the most charming guy. I mean, just, very accessible and just a nice guy, willing to talk to anybody about tennis at any time. And,
he is a great motivator, and he really self-taught himself, and he has discipline like no other, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
I feel that success really comes from, you have to have a lot of elements, not just a great coach, but, discipline is right. I mean, that's one or two on the top of my list, because if you're not consistent with that, and he has not slowed down at all. But what has changed also, as we all do as we go through our lives, is I feel that Nick built his name through his students at the beginning. So he drove us really, really hard. I was in tears all the time sometimes, and begging my parents to have me come home. But, obviously I didn't. And
right.
By the time I was 15, I was, I knew I was going pro. And like in the second pro tournament I played, I got to the finals and had Chris Evert, who at the time was one or two in the world,
wow.
In the third set. Yeah, yeah. So, and then everything happened so quickly. So that's where the fine line comes in, and that's where it just kind of things started to change for me. And that was a big adjustment.
Well, I was going to ask you, given the fact that, admittedly, you were driven to tears at points in time during your childhood from the training and I'm sure the pressure of being away from your parents on a daily basis. I mean, that's got to be hard on a young kid. Did you hesitate at all about introducing your own children to the sport and having them train with Nick?
No, not really, because it's really what I knew really well. And the thing is, and this might sound kind of cocky, but I knew that I could do it better than a lot of coaches, just because growing up in Nick's environment and only knowing that as that type of discipline and training, I took on that same behavior. And I'm not proud of, 100% of it, but I was out with my kids at 5:30 in the morning. They were playing 2 extra hours more than all the other kids that, when we initially had the academy. And I started them when they were, basically walking. And mm-hmm. But the thing is with Holden, he did play other sports too, but I made sure that they were geared around to making sure that his like soccer, for instance, that's so much more fun than running 6 miles every day or whatever. I mean, you're getting your cardio, you're getting your stopping, your starting, your coordination. Everything in my mind geared at that time around trying to make them better. And in retrospect, I don't think that was a good thing because it put a tremendous amount of pressure on them. Yeah, they won a lot. They won. And they were really good also when they were very young. But as a parent, I think it's a much different situation than it is when it's a coach doing it.
Right.
For the child. That's what I was trying to get at, for the child.
Sure. And your husband, Robert, did he train with Nick as well as coming up? Or?
No. I didn't even – do you know, my father had never even met Nick, and that was my father had never met Rob, sorry. He was alive, and to this day I wish he had, because we've been married 25 years and have 5 children. But then again, I know if my father was alive, I wouldn't be married. There's no way he would have let me walk down the aisle at just turning 19 years old and 3 months pregnant. Okay, and that would have been like just a horror show in itself. I can't even imagine. But life throws us things in its path, and in my journey, went one way and it went down. It went with tennis, but then there was a lot of, it's everything has to have balance. And I don't think there was a lot of balance, really. I didn't understand balance until I started to get a little bit older. And then mm-hmm. because I never was in balance, that was the thing. I mean, right from tennis, I went into building one of the most successful academies, when we did build it until we sold it. And I was on the court from 7:30 in the morning till 7 at night. And it just was, crazy. Now I'm thinking about it, it's crazy.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I cannot imagine. Let's talk a little bit about kind of the valley part of your career. At one point, you developed an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And I'm bringing this up not because, I want to focus on that necessarily, but I want to talk about what you feel like led you to that place and your parents' involvement at that point. And as a parent now yourself and for those of us listening, what we need to be looking out for to help our children avoid things like eating disorders as they go through their own development.
That's such a difficult, I can give you my experience, but it's just not athletes. I mean, although we have a much higher, women athletes have a much higher, percentage of, having an eating disorder of some kind, whether it is, anorexia or bulimia or overeating and binging, et cetera. I feel people ask me that question all the time, when and how and why. Well, if I really look at it, like outside of myself, you know, as soon as I turned pro, I immediately was Darling Carling. That became my name. You know, I was from Canada. I was so fortunate that the Canadians were always, always behind me, even through when they saw me at 92 pounds on the tennis court. You know, the press have always been my friend, and I was always good with them. And I think, thankfully, that it, I don't know if I'd be probably alive right now if I didn't have support that I had. But what happened is I think there was too much put on my platter. I mean, it wasn't just tennis. As soon as I got to the finals of Amelia Island, you know, like Ford Modeling hired me, okay? Here mm-hmm. I am looking at these girls. When you're an athlete, you're strong, okay? And I'm looking at these girls, and then I want to look like that and be beautiful like that. And then I have my own clothing line, and then I'm thinking, oh, gosh. And then I'm going up to Hawaii and seeing these girls that are really thin. And then I have – there was just – it was endless. And I don't think it has to do anything with the lack of love or the lack of support. It just started with wanting to look thinner. And
how old were you at this stage?
I was probably – see, it happened – this is a sad part about my career, really, and because I think that I would achieve so much more if I hadn't fallen into this trap and maintained a level of tennis, you know, high level. It started very quickly after I turned pro, and it manifested into this animal within, like, I would say probably a year to where
so
it
were
was
you
around
like 14
round the clock. No, not 14. I was probably almost 16. Yeah, I was.
Okay.
I can't give the exact age, but it after I got to the finals of Amelia Island playing Chris Everett, I just remember I was staying with Susie Mascaren and Lisa Bonder, and I knew what some girls were doing to stay then. And so I went along that path, but I kind of took it to a whole different level. I don't know when, if theirs or what happened with them, but for me, that was probably the most destructive period in my life because I couldn't stop, you know, and the deceiving thing about, you know, everybody thought I was anorexic. I was bulimic. I mean, but the thing is at the very, the bulimia is very deceiving because when you first start throwing up, I know this sounds disgusting to everybody who's listening, but you get very thin, obviously. But then mm-hmm. your body says, hello, you know what? We're just going to shut down because we know as soon as the food's coming in, it's going out. So it holds on. It's almost like your metabolism shuts down. And so I immediately, so when you saw me thin, people were like, oh, my gosh, you're anorexic. And the whole thing. And what they didn't realize is I wasn't starving myself. I was just eating and eating and eating and just, you know, expelling it. And mm-hmm. then my body decided, you know, it rebounded. And everybody thought I was well because I put on 20 pounds. Like the 20 pounds came on probably about a year and a half after it. And they thought I was well because I looked, you know, I looked normal again. And the reality is I was probably at the height of it then. And I tried so many times to stop, so many times. And like any addiction, when it's round the clock, it's, you know, everybody says, oh, you didn't have any willpower. It has nothing to do with willpower. You just need to get help, mm-hmm. and you need to want to get better. Really, those are the two key elements. And even then, it's tough.
Were the adults in your life aware of what you were doing?
I don't remember. This is a good. Gosh, I'm 45 now, so this is so eating disorders weren't really talked about then at all.
Right.
I mean,
that's why I'm asking.
Nobody knew what
yeah.
bulimia. If you were going to say bulimia, like now, it's just a common word to every girl. I mean, it's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go, you know, I just ate too much. I'm just going to go throw up in the toilet. And I look at them and I'm shocked when they tell me that, because that's my biggest fear is when I have more, like when I had morning sickness with Carling, I cried every time my head was over that toilet in the morning because I did not want to go back to, you know, because I was well then. I mean, you're never well, but I'm saying I was not throwing up. In fact, to this day, I will never overeat because I'm so terrified of, even though I know I wouldn't, you know, throw up, it's just, it's always there because that it could come back. And
well, it's like
I
an
don't
alcoholic
ever want to be
not drinking.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But it's, you know, it's different because, you know, I can go overboard in other areas, but this area was round, like, I think there's different levels. You know, when you talk about addiction in anything, there's
mm-hmm.
different levels of ladder. And they actually do have something called a Jekyll, like, that you can look at. I was at that very bottom where you either go up or you either die.
Hmm. How scary.
And that seems to be me with everything. Like, I have to get down. I have to get to a point where it's so bad that I either have to change the behavior or just stop doing it. That's basically.
Mm-hmm.
But thank God, you know, especially after I've had Lennon, who just turned 3 in April, and Theodora, you know, we no longer live in a tennis environment. I hardly play tennis, to be quite honest with you, and I've learned to, I found out really what I love, and I do love to play tennis, there's no doubt. You know, I've been putting my foot back on the court lately, but these two don't even know what tennis is. I mean, you know, they have little rackets, but they're better little golfers. I mean, Lennon loves to play golf. I mean, she just turned 3. She's got her little clubs, and she's already hitting the ball. But to me, it's all education. I mean, I have books all over the house, and I'm really key into making sure that the girls have the option of what they want to do in life. Mine didn't. I'll admit that. They didn't have the option.
Your older ones?
Yeah.
Okay. And did you?
No. No.
And,
I'll be really honest with you. But it was different.
Yeah.
See, it was different because it wasn't my... See, I was, like I said, I play all sports. I mean, if you would have asked, you know, I mean, in second grade, I got the Baby Tiger Award, you know, because I just did everything really well, and I loved hockey. I mean, horseback riding was my big thing, but you know, tennis was really my dad's thing, and then when you start getting better and you start seeing success, like anything, you start to enjoy it more. It wasn't
right.
that I didn't enjoy it. I mean, because I did, but I enjoyed so many things. Like, even to this day, it's there's so much in life. And unless you're truly passionate about something, and I don't think people really have that option to find their passion because of whether it's a job or they're told they have to do this or that, and it's a shame. So I just want my kids now, I don't care if they're good at sweeping, you know, being a carpenter, if that makes them
mm-hmm.
happy and they're passionate about doing that, you can't buy that. And
I agree with you. I agree with you
100%. And it's not about money at all anymore to me. I mean, I live very simply. And, yes, of course, I mean, it's nice to have nice things, but I don't think the same way I used to. I've always been a really nice person and giving person, but I'm really genuine about it. I'm not out for something. You know, I don't need to be benefited back now, you know, for an action or something that I did or said. You know, it's not about me anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I mean, it's refreshing to hear. And I mean, you've certainly had an interesting journey along the way. I want to touch a little bit about your experiences parenting your older kids mm-hmm. in tennis. And, you know, my target audience for Parenting Aces is tennis parents. I'm a tennis parent myself, and you know, we're all trying to learn and trying to forge, you know, the quote best path possible for our own children. And as you know, there's so many options in tennis, and it seems the options continue to grow and grow and grow every year, in terms of how to train, where to train, do you go to school, do you homeschool, do you play college tennis, do you go straight to the tour? I mean, they're just, you know, do you play USTA, do you play ITF, do you mix them up? And there are just so many options out there, and you know, it can drive you nuts trying to navigate through it. And meanwhile, the rules change and the ranking systems change and new ones pop
it's
out.
It's unbelievable. I don't. It's so different. See, I never got involved in all of that. I just... My kids played everything. They played up, mm-hmm. they played down, they played. I never got into the rules, really, or the conflicts with the parents. Or, I mean, it's brutal. I'm not going to say. I would not go through it again if you paid me. Because we, you know, I did it. I mean, I was at these tournaments all the time, and I was training them. And, you know, but then we have to go back to the child, okay? Every child is different. If, let's just say one of mine came up to me now and said, which they never did, okay? And said, God, I love tennis so much, Mom. I just live, die, and breathe it. Then I would absolutely go 110% the same way I did, you know, 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I would do it in a more positive factor. I don't think I drove them through. It was, you know, they hit a. If the shot wasn't the shot that I wanted them to hit, then we'd have to go back out and practice, you know, another gazillion times, even if they won the match. So I think they got more of a negative feedback, although they still got really good. So they don't have great. When tennis was their vehicle to get scholarships to any colleges they wanted, but then mm-hmm. then your education, I mean, there's such a fine line, and you got to think of the odds. The odds are your child is not going to make the pros, and if they do, you've got to be top 20 to really be making a living, and
right.
unless they're incredible at a young age, and I'm being really honest with you right now, okay? Make sure that they are educated just as well as they are playing these tournaments, because it goes by so quickly. And my son, literally, my eldest, all he does now, because he thinks that he wasn't smart enough, okay? All he does now is reads 24/7. I can't get him out of a book, okay? And it almost made him crazy. Like, he memorized the whole Webster Dictionary. Okay, this is when he got out of college, it consumed him to the point where he almost went crazy with it, because he felt like, oh, I didn't get a good enough education. Although I gave him a great education, it's just I pushed them so hard with the tennis that it was like they didn't, even though the education was great that they were getting, and I did give them that, they had tutors, they didn't care about it at the time.
Sure.
So I was always fighting it with them. I mean, but then again, they knew, in my mind, they knew that they could get away with it just because, you know, they were trained so hard in winning. So
right.
That's the part that I'm not really proud of, okay?
And will you do it differently with the little ones?
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding? It wouldn't even be a thought. First of all, they'd have to say to me, you know, Mom, I really love, okay, let's say they said tennis, okay, they won't probably. And because they don't see it. Remember, I don't live in it. I moved out.
Right.
I lived and trained other kids too when I was in IMG. We lived there for 9 years in an environment that was only tennis.
Mm-hmm.
And all these parents saw me train my kids, and then next thing you know, they're wanting to train theirs. And then I take those responsibility, the kids that I train on, very seriously also. And it was just, looking at it now, it's kind of insane. But when that's what you know and what you do, it's very normal. Like I couldn't do it now because I do so many other things now. I think, God, how could I even fit? I mean, where would I fit those hours in?
Well,
I love spending the time with my kid, my little girls right now, and doing things that I never did with the other ones.
Do your older ones call you out on that ever?
Oh, are you kidding? Yeah. But then again, okay, my daughter, you know, she went to school just turning 17. She had a choice of any college in the country on a scholarship, okay? And then she got hired at USCB as one of the youngest assistant coaches recommended by Stella Sampras for the Grouchos under Simon. Oh, gosh, I had such a tough time saying his last name. Febido, I know how to spell it, but they just hired him. He's going to revamp that whole team. And, you know, she didn't love it. She didn't have it's a dream job for anybody to get an assistant coaching job with no experience because in a Division I school. It's unheard of. You have to pay your dues. And Carlin got in there at 21 years old.
Wow.
And she was great at it. She was great at it, but she couldn't stand it. And basically, yeah, I said to her, okay, it was very difficult because once you give that job up, you give that job up. And, for me, I would have loved that job because you're mm-hmm. traveling, you're dealing. You see, I actually like coaching. I like dealing with other kids and the parents. I like the social. I did like the social aspect of it. I mean, I didn't have one parent that moved on to another coach. I was very fortunate with that because, you know, they also had to do other things other than just a lesson with me, you know, off the court. And I built relationships with the parents. And then I always made sure that there was a good relationship between a parent and a child. Once I started seeing things get ugly, and it does, I remove myself in a very polite way from the situation because it's way too messy to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so hard when it's a single sport. I mean, there's no doubt. The team sports, it's, you know, you can not feel well one day, and you can rely on your teammates. And still be making, you know, yourself look great the next day. Tennis is brutal. They say next to boxing, tennis is the most difficult sport.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I had Carlos Goffey on the show last week, and he said the same thing. His advice to parents is don't even let them play tennis until after they have several seasons of a team sport under their belt so they can learn to compete in the safety of a team. And mm-hmm. and then when they have the maturity to compete one-on-one, then you let them compete, you know, in an individual sport. But and it sounds like you're kind of a similar mindset in terms of, you know, how difficult it is, especially for these young ones to go out there and it's them against their opponent, period, the end.
Well, also, too, for the parents, I mean, you give up everything. You give up, I mean, and it's expensive. I mean, the sport is ridiculously expensive. I mean, and we did everything cheaply. I mean, we drove everywhere. You know, I told him not to UCLA and was playing the Futures. Rob and I took three boys on the team with us all through Peoria, Illinois, all those Futures. And Ruby was playing them at the age of, like, 14. And I mean, there were some fun summers because we were a group. But, I mean, I don't know how these parents can afford to do it. I mean,
well, I don't know how you did it with three kids at a time. You know, I'm doing it with one and I'm struggling.
Well, I never, see, the thing was, is we don't care about rankings too much because I knew, for instance, okay, I'll give a perfect example. Holden was, decided he didn't want to go pro. He did amazing in the Key Biscayne tournament. If you ever go, they feature like 16 of the top juniors in the world. And they go and they play against each other, and it's kind of like a recreation, you know, side for all the mm-hmm. people that go to see, you know, top, you know, juniors. Holden mm-hmm. went to the semi, which is the last four, and he beat Jesse Levine, who, you know, I'm sure you know him, and
yep.
Marcus Fugate, and, you know, in the juniors, he beat DePotro. You know, he lost to DePotro once, and then he beat him the next time. I mean, Holden has victories. He has great victories. So people mm-hmm. knew he was really good. But if you were to look at his ranking, I don't even know what he was ranked because we didn't follow the tournaments because there's no way we could afford it if I did it with all three. So I just made sure he was always competing. And so when it came to the UCLA, for example, he went to USC. First, he went to USC because he decided he didn't want to go pro. And the head coach looked at him and just basically says, well, and I love Peter now. You know, I really like that, you know, the men's coach.
Sure.
And he did say, you know, after the first year, he made the biggest mistake not taking Holden. So I called up Billy Martin, and I didn't know anything about college tennis. So I called up Billy Martin, and Billy Martin was one of the great juniors of his time. And I explained to him, everybody knew Holden Scusso, but they had thought, oh, well, Holden, they had heard Holden quit tennis. I said, you have the diamond in the rough, Billy. I said, you've got to take him. I said, I promise you, you will not be disappointed. And because no one had heard Holden's name, he kind of like just, he got this girlfriend and that year was a disaster, but he still was playing, but just not playing mm-hmm. tennis. And mm-hmm. so Billy took him and sad to say this, but the one boy, I don't want to get it on USC, he had not lost one match all four years. All 4 years were there. So we're at the NCAAs. Holden had to play, because Holden played one. For UCLA, his first year.
Okay.
He ends up playing. How bad is this, though, for the boy on USC? He hasn't lost one match his whole career there. Okay. Holden plays him, beats him. So this kid's got to go out. And then Peter Smith, who didn't take Holden. Yeah. So it was the biggest slap in the face, really. But that was his best year at UCLA because I knew Holden didn't love tennis, but he still had the hours and hours in him.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he had a coach who knew how to motivate him, it sounds like.
Billy was the greatest. I mean, he was.
Sure.
I was so fortunate because I was just so blessed. I mean, we had the best experience at UCLA with Billy Martin and Stella Sampras. I mean, because Carlene went at such an early age. You know, came down to Duke or UCLA, and then I'm so glad she went there because she lived with her brother. And it was just, and Holden went a year later, so that was a big problem. He went, you know, most kids, he went a year later.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
Carlene was a year younger.
As you're talking, you and I have so much overlap in our lives. It's very interesting. My husband and I graduated from UCLA. My oldest daughter... Yes, my oldest daughter graduated from USC, and my three kids together, kind of you roll all of them into you. My oldest is an actor, my middle one is a horse kid, she's 21, and then my son's a tennis player. So it's very interesting to talk to you and hear
the horses too. Oh
yeah, so
that's brutal. That's my 3-year-old is crazy about them because her godmother has like the best ponies in the country. So
cool.
I mean, yeah. So we were at Wellington every weekend, basically during the season. But I don't want her getting into that because that sport is I mean, you can't even, it's money that you can't believe. Well, you know. Is she equestrian?
Well, no, I mean, she rode for a couple of years, but that's, you know, when people start talking money and tennis and all, I say, well, you know, yes, it's very expensive, but I had a kid who rode horses for a couple of years, so I have to put it in perspective.
I know.
Now she's in college, and she just rides for pleasure and works at a barn for, you know, satisfaction.
But,
so it's not on my pocketbook anymore, which is good, but it's just so funny to, you know, to hear your stories and kind of equate it to different aspects in my life too. So that's what I love about talking to other tennis people. There's a fraternity or sorority there that, you know, any of us who have ever been in this world in any way, shape, or form probably have things in common that we never realized. And that's what I think is so great about talking to other tennis parents, because even though you may have girls and I may have boys or vice versa, we're all going through very similar types of experiences
and have things to learn. Yeah. It's just different situations and different personalities, really.
Yeah.
I mean, we all share the common bond. But don't kid yourself. Some are way worse than others. you never know, like I say, you know, you never know what goes behind that closed door. You can see one, you know, people, I've learned, not just through tennis, but through, you know, I've been very active in doing a lot of other, ventures, you know, recently. And it's amazing how the trust barrier really is so limited. People really don't follow through. A lot of them really don't follow through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they talk a big game, and they talk this and they talk that, and take that and put it to tennis too, like a coach, because everybody seems to sell. But
sure.
And
well, if you were giving advice to a parent who's trying to figure out a coaching situation for their child, regardless of the child's age, what are the top three things you would tell them to look for, or questions to ask? Because that's one of the most common questions I get, and, you know, my experience is very limited. I mean, my son's been with two coaches, and, you know, he's getting ready to turn 17. So I don't, you know, I'm not a good resource for that, but I know people who are, like you, and so what do you tell people?
Well, first of all, I would look at the success of the coach first. I wouldn't
from what perspective
anything. I would research that first. Okay, which coach is having the best success with their players coming in not great? Okay, which ones are improving and starting to get to the second or third or fourth round now? Okay, because that there tells you the program is good.
Okay.
Okay. Then I would look at, obviously, the environment it's in, the personality. I think it's a critical element that you have to, and I mean, the most important factor really does come down to the relationship the parent has with the coach, because a child still has a huge emotional development to go through. And if the coach and the parent aren't on the same page with that, you can't work as a team, because there's going to be so many times that the child's going to come home saying, you know what, he's doing a terrible job. I want another coach. Or maybe they're going through a period where they're not winning, and they were. And if you don't have a relationship with the coach where you can, you know, not overburden him, because that's the worst, but, you know, you need to know what they're doing and what they're learning at the time, because if to get better, you sometimes have to get worse,
mm-hmm.
to change something. And nobody likes to lose. And that's a lot of the times when, and then the parents fall into the trap too, where they're like, well, you're not doing a good enough job because, you know, my child's not winning. But then again, there needs to be a major change in the forehand grip. You know, they don't want to give up that time of change. So everything's instant gratification. So I would recommend
Yeah, I think that's the truth.
Yeah, yeah, and the fact of the matter is nothing. Yeah, you can have it occasionally. Reality is not like that long term. And patience, and also the personalities have to work together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know your child. If you know your child, I would spend a lot of time with the coach, and really get to know, talk to other parents, see what they, you know, feel and think, how their experience was. I mean, everybody moves. I don't see anybody that stays with the same coach anymore. As soon as they move like two matches, they're moving on. I mean, because the coaches are just, I mean, they're hunting that. I mean, they're just as bad. I mean, they'll steal you right under,
right.
you while they're your best your buddy.
Well, why do you think that is? I mean, why do you think
because they're so
that
off, because
parents
all,
are jumping?
Who's jumping?
Why are the parents jumping ship from their coaches just because their kids lost a couple matches?
Because
is it a lack of understanding?
No, because what they do is they see another kid. They'll see, let's just say Joe Schmo. They see
mm-hmm.
Joe Schmo starting to win a lot of matches, okay, who wasn't winning before. And these coaches are like vultures because they need the work. And there are so many of them out there. I mean, I live in Bradenton here. I can't even tell you how many different academies are around here.
Oh, yeah.
And these coaches go to every tournament. They bring their kids, and then they just kind of subtly come in and start talking to, you know, the parents and then the parents will see, oh, yeah, he's playing really well. And then next thing you know, he says, oh, come on over for a day. Or I know it's unbelievable. It's a dog-eat-dog world with the coaches. And then the parents fall into it. And, you know, hopefully it's a situation, you know, that benefits and works. But, see, that was one of the other downfalls that I had. Too, and I'm sorry I didn't bring that up when it came to the eating disorder, was I was taken away from Nick. As soon as I got to the finals of Neil Island, my father said, listen, Nick, you need to start traveling with her to these tournaments. And Nick booked them and said, are you effing crazy? I mean, every other word was F then, too. he had profanity like no other. I mean, I'm still trying to clean up my mouth. No, seriously, he was brutal in my day. Okay? I don't know how these guests that go on, they tolerated that part.
Your dad wanted him to travel with you, and he said he
yeah, and so, and then the next thing you know, I did what most parents did. I went from one coach to another. But the what was missing, okay, and I did have great coaches that money could buy at that time because, you know, I had contracts, and I mean, I can't tell you how many I had. But I knew how to not train as hard. See, Nick trained as hard. And I was the type of player that I needed to have my shots because it wasn't like I had a huge weapon. I won. I had all the shots. And
mm-hmm.
I was creative. But I didn't overpower you. I didn't have a great serve. You know, I was a very smart player. And if I didn't practice all those shots, all the time, my game, you know, would go down. And so I just started slacking. And when you start slacking becomes it starts to become a habit too.
Sure.
And then you get to an age where you start calling the shots. And then my dad
and
got
so,
sick. And mm-hmm. that was, and so he really basically just not pulled back, but he had started the USFL, and I was really, and my mom was traveling with me, but and God bless her, she's the greatest mother in the world, but she didn't know anything about tennis. So when I said, you know, he's not doing a good job, Mommy, I need to change, or I'd tell my agent, and just because I wasn't winning. And so I'm right in there with the rest of them.
Mm.
But I was making change because I could, because I was the one, I was basically the pro.
Right, right. We have a caller that just called in. Let me just see if they have a question for you. Hang on one sec. So, caller, are you there? Area code 609?
Yes, I am.
Hi, do you have a question for Carling?
I do. Hey, Carling, it's Ed Fang from Princeton, New Jersey.
Oh, that's where I wanted Carling. Oh, I shouldn't say that. Oh, anyway, it's a beautiful place.
I have two questions for you.
Sure.
My first question is, what was the most difficult mental aspect of playing on the tour?
That is a very, you know what? I have not been asked that question. I would say, I'll tell you exactly what was the most difficult part, is keeping a positive momentum. Because you're traveling so much, and it's a very lonely sport.
Mm-hmm.
And when you lose, and you have to be there for the rest of the week, you get down, and you get unmotivated, and it's keeping yourself inspired, regardless of what the actual result is.
Mm-hmm.
I would say. Yeah, because once you start, you have to win in any sport 3-1 to maintain a positive attitude about what you're doing. And it's
right.
So easy just to forget about those 3 wins and you take that 1 loss and start thinking, oh, I'm so depressed. Or it's just maintaining the mental. The mental balance of knowing that you can go from tournament to tournament and it's not going to be perfect. I had so many ups and downs. I had so many ups and downs. That's even before my eating issue.
Right. So would you say being resilient and not getting too hung up on losses?
Yeah, because, you lose. And, the worst is when you're up, I was up 6-3, 5-2 against Helena Suková, who I don't know was 5 in the world at that time, at the Canadian Open, okay, in my home country. And I end up in 30 love, and I end up losing the match. I mean, that just put me into such a deep end of, whereas, hey, it's going to happen, I mean,
right.
That stuff's going to happen, and it's more difficult when you're on your own doing it, and you're in, and it's, what I'm trying to get is, it's more difficult expressing it, and if you get it out and express it, it becomes much easier to get over it, and I never did that.
Mm.
I withheld all that emotion.
And then it builds, doesn't it?
Yeah, it builds. And some, and when you're when you're hungry, angry, tired, or all those things that don't make it any better, it just can explode.
Mm.
So
okay.
Here's
my second part. What do you know now that you wish you knew when you were on the tour?
Okay, we could go on for days on this one.
Okay, we're down to our last minute and a half. So
okay, all right. What would I do? I would take it easy. I would enjoy it more. I wouldn't put so much pressure on myself. It's easier said than done. Who knows if I would have won if I wouldn't have put pressure on myself? But balance. There's got to be a sense of, I'd have a team around me, which I didn't have. A support group that was always building me up and making me feel, I'm very hard on myself. So I probably would have put a group of people around me that would have helped me maintain the balance.
Mm. I like how you said you put the pressure on yourself, not you were getting pressure from results or other people or big fans.
Oh, no,
like
I never know. I don't ever. People could say anything about me, and it doesn't bother me at all. I put pressure on myself to get things done. You know, I'm not a procrastinator, and I go, like, all out to get something done. Just, it's my issue. It's not their issue or it's us, you know. So that's one area I do struggle, you know, with still, and I really hold myself back with these two children.
Thank you for those
Great.
Questions,
Thank
Ed.
You.
We're down to the last end of our show and actually are a little past our 60-minute mark. But, Carlene, I'd like to close with one last question that your friend Tim sent to me, which has to do with you and your dad. And you've mentioned your dad several times, and I know he was extraordinarily involved in your tennis growing up and in your career. Can you recall your most special moment in tennis that you and your dad had together?
God, there were so many. You know, you know what it was? I have to tell you. It was when I won the Canadian Open, the Women's Canadian Open, and I was 13. And I came back. I was down, and it rained. And there's a great picture of it, too. And I came back, and I won the match. Then I got into the finals, and I won the finals easily. And I could just tell, him being Canadian and me at that age, being so young, he was so proud. He was so proud of me, you know, U.S. Open semis. But there's something about being in Canada and winning that at such a young age and really fighting to win it. I was down 4-0 in the third set.
Wow.
Yeah, and it rained.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and then when I just remember. Yeah, I remember that really vividly.
That's so awesome. So that's a message that other parents, I hope, hear and take to heart that, you know, somebody that's had as many experiences in tennis as you have, both as a player and as a parent, that your most fond memory with your own parent is knowing that he was proud of you. And I think that's a takeaway message for all of us, that we need to make sure that we show our kids that we're proud of them, regardless of outcomes, regardless of results, you know, that they're our kids and we love them and we're proud of them any which way. And hopefully they'll hold those memories near and dear to their hearts into adulthood and their own years parenting as well. Carlene, thank you so much for being with us today. It's just been such a pleasure to chat with you and get to know you a little bit. I look forward to hearing about your next phase of adventure.
It will be an adventure. Where it will go,
well,
I don't know. But
well,
I always love the adventure.
Little ones coming up. Yeah, that's awesome. And your love of life and your love of excitement and adventure, it just comes across loud and clear over the radio waves. So thank you for sharing that with us. And
no problem.
I hope you'll come on again and update us on where your little ones are headed, where your big ones are headed. And, you know, I think it'll be fun
where
to
I'm
follow
headed,
your family.
If I'm alive.
Where you're headed. Exactly. Exactly.
God, I hope it's not the grave anytime soon. I feel like it's
alive. Please. It sounds like you've still got lots left to accomplish, so I doubt that that's the case. But thank you for being with us, and I hope you've enjoyed chatting and sharing your experiences. To my listeners, the link to today's broadcast will be on ParentingAces.com on our radio show page later today, so please check it out and share it as you see fit. I will talk to you guys next week. Looking forward to it. Our guest is still to be determined. It's summer, man. It's been tough to get people to commit to come on the air, but I've got a list of people that I'm talking to. So I look forward to being on the air with y'all again next week. Have a great week. Stay hydrated. Stay cool. And I'll talk to you next Monday.
Thanks, Lisa.